Well, my feeling is if you stick with the authorities, the principal engineers, the one who really worked on the program, and you get them to review and read what you've written. I mentioned to you that this book idea really grew out of an article I wrote for Automobile Quarterly. And I got to, as I mentioned, to interview John Young, Charlie Duke, and Gene Cernan, and as well as Mr. Maria. And they all got copies of this article to review it, and then I made the corrections and then incorporated them. And I've operated this way for 25 years, and it amazes me that there are magazine writers or book authors that don't believe in doing
that. That whole scenario, I call that my pillar of the imposter, and it is a sad story.
Believe me, it's not even worth mentioning. It's like...
Well, but I only mentioned it to you because...
You want me to avoid it.
I want you to.
Absolutely.
Sure. And like you said, it's not worthy of even saying that it's there as a problem because that gives credence to it.
Exactly right.
It's very frustrating. You can tell that we are very frustrated. If you talk to Sonny about it, I'll see Sonny here. Sonny's helping me with this moon buggy race. We have a competition over there called the Most Unique Award, and we did it last year.
Mm-hmm.
And this year it's going to be geared more to what would they do to try to better conquer this dust challenge that we've got.
I think that's good because one of the things I want to get into in a little bit is they just released the RFP for the crew exploration vehicle. And obviously, at some point down the road, if they haven't considered it already, is they're going to need a new vehicle on the surface of the moon to traverse. What lessons are they going to pick up from what they learned with the LRV and apply them to the future? And I think this moon buggy race thing is just, you know, it gives prospective engineers...
Mm-hmm. The vehicle, it's got to fold up too, just like our real rover did. It's got to have that feature to it, and it's got to fold out, and then you drive it around. They generally go with spoke type, bicycle type tires.
I've seen that, yeah.
But then that lends them into the fact that the spoke interface there, the wheel and all, is typically the kind of thing that gets jammed and broken.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because if you look at what the rover's wheels is up to, and what we had was the wire mesh wheel back to that.
Now, was that a product of GM, or did Boeing come up with that concept and execute it?
The way it worked, they were the Boeing was the prime contractor, and General Motors was the primary sub on the mobility system. And as such, you'll say that they both combined together to bid to NASA that overall package, which won out. There was probably three or four, as I remember, main competitors back in that day.
Yeah.
By the Bible. He's referred to as being a main force behind trying to understand the whole mobility, off-road type mobility. You know, what's your energy dissipated when the wheels are acting? Think about now. As I mentioned back before, these fellas had information about what the soil was. We didn't get it till 69, though. And as far as getting soil back from the moon, action was of it. A lot of people doubted, you know, that you'd be able to walk at all.
So the samples that were brought back from 11 and 12 were actually used in studies for...
They were at least more of a verification saying, hey, you had, if you look back at the whole scenario of things as it went along, we had the landing of the surveyor. That was a major step that you had, but it didn't sink in, I guess.
Yeah, I remember the close-up of the landing pad there that sank down about 2-3 inches in the dust.
There's a capability there. Then when Apollo 11 landed, similar type thing. You can always, even on the lunar module, you have these big pads there for the landing to try to support the weight. And it worked fairly well. They didn't sink in that bad. You had that lack of knowledge, or that, and the guys did have to work a lot, you know, with testing, you know, as to different theories. And they worked up good lunar soil simulants that are described in that document and went through the testing. And then the amazing thing to me was that they predicted that you would have about 10% slip. Slip is the amount of time that you're not actively engaged between the wheel and the surface. That's a typical off-road or a vehicle type term. There's slip. It's a measure of that inefficiency.
Right.
And so they predicted about 10%. Guess what they got? We figured out from the energy dissipated on. They could back out here. There was about 10% slip that we had on them.
Exactly.
That's amazing to me. It just shows the level of detail work that they did.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of amazed that there was no means of monitoring the LRV systems, or at least the batteries, on the way to the moon.
No telemetry at all.
That amazed me. Considering how many monitoring systems they have.
Two drivers, though. When everything was over, while we sat there, we said, hey, we missed the boat. We should have a locked up ammonia boiler type thermal control system, heat exchanger, that would have precluded dust exposure.
Yes, yes.
We didn't have the weight for it. We're back to the weight, and that's what you had with the lack of telemetry. They had the systems were so massive and large and heavy that they couldn't afford that. You had an additional problem. You think about the rover being stowed as it was. It had to have some kind of an umbilical that would have had to pass from the rover into the lunar module.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
And back up into the asset space, forward into the command. It would have been a very complex, impossible, really, at the time. Overly complex system to do that, or you would have to have a system that radiated and sent its information to some kind of antenna system that would have been yet another burden weight on the system. You know, we didn't have the weight to do any of that.
Okay, let me back up a little bit here, because you went to Marshall right out of college. Where did you graduate from?
I went to Florida State University.
Oh, okay. Okay, so how did you learn? How did you? Because you were a co-op student.
College, and then I went there to Marshall as a full-time employee in 69.
In 69, okay. Were you exposed to the preliminary rover designs then? Because they come up,
Not really, no. It's pretty much, when I came on board, they had made the decision and had these proposals came in. I was in there early on to the final reviews of those proposals in the summer of 69. In addition to taking off time, they actually allowed us to go down to Apollo 11 launch. They gave us a week off. So a group of us went down to the Apollo 11 launch, which I'm glad I can tell my posterity here that I saw the moon landing launch. I saw several launches, but even got to see Apollo 17 real live, the nighttime launch. That was a heck of a thing, as I'm blazoned in my memory.
Yes. Nighttime launch.
Yeah, that was Saturn V. I've seen nighttime shuttle launches, but it was not. The shuttle goes a lot faster.
Yeah.
So it's away, and the Saturn V did not. It was a beast. It was a marvelous beast.
Well, I always marvel every time I go to the Saturn V building at the visitor center.
Yes, right.
And it's just such a beautifully restored thing, just so beautifully done. I'm glad it's there. For those who were not alive at the time, all this transpired, that they can actually see the rocket that made it all possible.
You've never seen the breakout on what the difference stages are, though, that is not a single rocket. It is pieces of test stages and other stages. I've got that breakout I can send you that somebody has compiled.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's bits and pieces from everywhere, actually.
Yeah, like, because I did a quiz and nobody ever, the kids didn't respond to me, but I said, hey, tell me where the three Saturn V's are that didn't go to the moon. And so it's a bit of a trick question, though, because you can find most of the two parts, but two stages you'll never find because they're in the ocean. They were the Skylab booster.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit of a trick question here. They
okay, yes. Yeah.
Some of them are on the Earth, but some of them are inside. They're in the ocean.
Yeah. I wonder if they've ever photographed the how much structural damage was to the booster, to the point where Cameron loves diving on Titanic and stuff like this to photograph it. I wonder if they've ever photographed the booster.
I don't have
booster.
Any knowledge that they ever went out and tried to find. I have seen pieces at the Space and Rocket Center, a piece of a Titan or an Atlas or something laying. It's kind of like along that line.
Yeah.
Showing.
Yes. What was the atmosphere? Since you started, and you were very young when you started on the proposal, can you get at Marshall? Can you give me a feel for what the atmosphere was like once the so the contract was awarded to Boeing and it was pretty much off from there? How did the liaison work between Marshall and Boeing and some of the other subcontractors?
Very, very good. I've been asked that question before by this lunar data mining interview. There, do you think that we could hope for that now in the present day? That camaraderie or that dedication? And I said, I don't know if I can believe that you can have it anymore because of proprietarianism about how the people deal with things, you know, and legalistic. No, we clearly had a goal to meet, and there was a very good relationship between the contractor. I'll give an example of in the deployment system there. You clearly had this desire, early desire, to make it be totally automatic, but I've been told by Roy that first time he got involved in the program, he went over there at Boeing, and they were going to have a demonstration of how they were going to do this deployment, and the thing just literally fell out onto the floor. It was trying to manage too much going on, so it literally almost self-destructed, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
It was not repeatable, too. And people, generally in engineering, you want to have things be repeatable, understandable.
Yes, that's right.
You think about it, your car is repeatable. I mean, it's, car being sealed up. Of course, you couldn't really work on them nowadays, right?
That's true, yeah.
Let me mention one thing about General Motors and about what I've noticed here. I can't absolutely verify, but I think there's been a little bit of false advertising put out there. When I look at the video they've got on TV for General Motors here recently, when I look at that image, I think there's been a mirror image shifting of the image itself. Because it looks like to me the astronaut's on the wrong side of the vehicle.
I have not seen that yet.
And when I went through the Huntsville airport, I looked closely at the model they've got in there, and the suckers did the same thing. They've got the TV camera and the high-gain antenna switched. It's almost like, why would somebody make a picture up like that that's wrong?
Well, yeah, why would they flip the video?
Why would they flip it? But it's clearly, I looked at it closely a couple Sundays ago when I was through there. I said, wait a minute, this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'll tell you what I see on the commercials. I see that wrong
Yeah, it was Charlie.
Photograph the other astronaut driving by or driving away and try to get some information about the rooster tailing the dust with fender extensions on early on. So we didn't get full information there because later on we lost them. But as you've seen the movies, the driving, and what's interesting on Apollo 15, we didn't get that because the movie camera jammed up.
Yes.
We did not get any of that engineering data on Apollo 15.
Mm-hmm. Object being the chassis body. Mm-hmm.
So you could say that was an attempt to try to get some information, engineering information. It was.
What I think is interesting about the rover program, because basically it all came together in the space of about 18 months or so.
Yes,
is that right?
I try to show on the one chart, and I try to show that just the thermal testing that was done, much less all the other dynamic structural. I look back and I say, how did we do all this in 17 months or so? Which is kind of amazing.
Well, it must have been a 24/7 effort.
It was. In fact, if you talk to Sonny, he would say there that that's what raised the cost.
Yes.
Because we were criticized. The program started out, I think, about $19 million was the original award. And I think it cost 38 or 39.
Mm-hmm.
What Sonny told me.
Mm-hmm.
It was about double.
Yes. Oh, it was, okay.
It used to be in Santa Barbara, actually a little town called Gobea, California.
But
that working relationship, back to your original question there, that was an excellent working relationship that between the government and the contractors. The goal was there clearly, and I like to say that, as well as the clear involvement that astronaut crews in the design. The feedback was there, which was excellent.
I know John Young was telling me he gave considerable input regarding the hand controller.
Oh yeah, the hand controller. The hand controller, it took Marshall and the Boeing folks and everybody involved a little while to understand what the astronauts really wanted to have.
Mm-hmm.
So it was redesigned a couple of different times. I don't know the exact number, but it certainly went through some iterations there, trying to get the functions down to match up with the way the crew wanted to be more like the lunar module. They wanted to have consider how the hand controller had to control all functions. It would push forward to increase speed.
Right.
And pulling back gave it braking, and it had to have steering in the, and all of that steering left and right. It was all in that one single hand controller.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a lot of functions to do, and yes, John's right, that the astronauts were a very big part of that. They were a part also of the stowing and the deployment and working through that. As opposed to the original version, it wouldn't work. The automatic, which would have been instantaneous, hopefully, earlier. It took them about 8 to 10 minutes with the other system to get it deployed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had to correct the people that when they were interviewing me before, they kind of had somebody got in their mind that there was a failure on Apollo 15, that it didn't deploy right. Well, it was a little bit stuck on the saddle assembly there.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly the astronauts were there. All they had to do was go over and jimmy it, lift it up, work it around a little bit, and it came off,
I think what's really amazing is that considering the how violent, I'd have to say violent, the launch is, the shocks that the vehicle, the loading and unloading that takes place during staging, and then the trip to the moon and all that, and yet when they landed, they pull the straps and the pins, and the thing deploys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I mean, basically the thing was practically 100% reliable. They had a few bugs, but I mean, I think in the whole picture, it performed amazingly well, really.
Yeah, and they talk about one guy in the interview I was having before, he said that what he said, all he could remember was that Marshall got some good publicity in that on Apollo 15, the front steering didn't work at first, for the first little drive around.
Yeah.
And then when they came back after the first night, they back the first rest period, came back out, well, the steering worked, okay. The point is that what I've kind of tried to explain that is that my way of thinking, yes, they had a problem to look at initially that the front steering didn't work. Okay, I don't know what it was. Something was jammed up or it was thermally related. We don't know. But they probably, what they went to was that they had a redundant rear steering. Okay, they went and used that, and they didn't drive all that much on the first EVA.
Yeah.
With the first EVA, you had to do the ALSEP package deployment. It was always a high priority. You get the lunar surface experiment package out.
I remember that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, there wasn't anything they physically did to flip any switches or do anything. Yes, they worked through it at night trying to figure it out. But it was more that I think it got jostled around or whatever happened. And it worked probably during that first EVA, would have worked. But they didn't. I mentioned one thing back to the... Tremendous load on them, you know. If you've seen the pictures when they got back into the lunar module, they're it's like a swamp inside their suit. They've sweated it.
Yes.
And they're covered with dust. Okay, inside has gotten migrated in on them, you know. It's a tremendous thing. Yeah, kind of what I've been told in reading is that you had a disinclination of them to even take the suits off. To take the suits off was an arduous process.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't want to have to go through all that taking things off.
Mm-hmm.
And the dust had gotten into the seals on the rotating members there, the joints, the rings that are used to
clean. Yeah. Sure.
And they had back there in that middle 70s, we had a reformatting, a downsizing of the government that was a crunch on there. And they were essentially, in the politics of things, offered that, yes, Marshall could keep doing the rovers, but they got to move out to California. They got that the effort. But I don't want to get the story confused. We'll have to talk to the other fellow about it. But the story is that you kind of ask, Dave, why did continue on with the rovers, you know. Why did they automatically jump over to JPL? Well, politics aside, it was more a story that Marshall chose not to send that group of people or to program that group of people to continue that work. And
mm-hmm.
So the JPL folks picked it up.
I see.
It was, because I normally think people ask, hey, now, whether you put that in your book or what kind of story you get there, I don't know.
Because I've been reading Michigan's book, Sojourner, and he talks about the first one that they did, Sojourner Pathfinder, as well as Spirit and Opportunity. But actually, those happened almost after he completed the book. He did get to mention them slightly, so I'll probably be going out there to speak with him. Because, as I mentioned, the book is going to cover the engineering of the rover, the three Apollo missions. There's going to be a chapter on the Martian rovers, and then there's going to be a final chapter on what rovers are going to be used in the future when we go back.
I would encourage you. I've been to Russia, to the Lunokhod facility. That was a tremendous experience for me. That back in the 70s, back during that whole process, I knew the Russians were into this, and that they had their own little Lunokhod, little Moonwalker rovers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I remember reading.
Yeah,
isn't that something? It kept going and going.
They would have had a half-life of many more years and would have worked. But the Russians, they solved it with isotope heaters, little radio, RHUs, radioisotope heating units. But there was beyond a heating unit. They had a baffle system inside and all. But I'd always been intrigued for 3 decades here of knowing that. And then I got an opportunity to start conversing over the internet. The internet is so magically wonderful here. That I got to conversing with the folks. They invited me to come to Russia back last October. I went over there, went into the building where they actually built their little rovers, had the presentation. I've got some good relationship now with those folks.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I didn't have to go through a lot of hoops here on what we call now the International Traffic and Arms Reduction.
Oh, yeah.
Arms Regulation, ITAR.
Yeah.
What people told you about ITAR. So to involve the Russians in your book and all, it would be, I would encourage it, and I'm trying to encourage the cooperation with those folks. But I'm not getting very far because it's not invented here syndrome.
Exactly. When I submitted this book proposal to the publisher, they in turn submitted to various people on their editorial advisory board. Every one of them said, you've got to mention the Lunokhods.
Yep.
And that floored me because it didn't even register with me because I was so focused on the LRV, the Martian rovers, and what the U.S. was doing. But if I did not mention them to the best of my ability, everybody would say Anthony Young failed to mention the Lunokhod. So.
Right, and beyond Lunokhod, I didn't know if you knew, but I have documents here and I've talked to folks about it. The Russians, on some of their early failures on the landings on Mars, they had a little rover on the crashed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But for the fact that they crashed, in fact, but the Mars missions, I think it's only, 30-40% have been successful in the scheme of things.
Yeah, when you're going to Mars, it's just like, the guys really white-knuckled it for Spirit and Opportunity, and I think it's just astounding that the vehicles did so. Remember that one, I forget which one of the rovers, but it actually went into a mode where they couldn't communicate, and they thought they'd lost it.
Remember that? They got by that. They've had battery problems. I think they've had several things they've worked through, and you're exactly right, reprogramming, and they've had that flexibility, and of course now they've had months and weeks to do it. Remember now, we're back on the moon. We had real-time activities going on with astronauts involved. It was in a different psychology. It was high level, high stress. I don't know how to thinking back. Yeah, we made it through it, but it was certainly. It was also that we had to have the contingency prep for getting in there, because that's what I'm trying to talk to these folks about now. They're talking about going back to the moon. They're going to do this. Do something in orbit. They got to do with it. The problem with the thermal, they're going to try to get around it, because they're going to say now, okay, we're only going to be on the moon's surface during the sunlit period, and we'll come back up with to get into orbit, you know, and not have to endure the cold. I'm trying to tell them, hey, wait a minute. What if it's prevented here and something happens to you and you can't take off? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to?